first and foremost thing you should know about him is that you are not at any time trying to find something wrong with the preclair to make right. Now, you see that? You're not trying to find something wrong to make right with the preclair. You are trying to find, rather than that, how you can make him better. Now, you really don't even have to look for a barrier toward his being better in order to make him better, because there are certain things he ought to be able to do. And therefore, we are not terribly interested in why he can't do them. But we are interested in his doing them. Now, if you took the attitude, not that you're a drill sergeant Seaver, you see, but if you took the attitude that the fellow who went down the parade ground always out of step and so forth was doing this because his shoes were on backwards or something of that sort, and that you had to change something about the man at once, you would immediately cut down efficiency to the degree that you would never use this one. You'd never use this particular way of handling a preclear. And this is quite a legitimate way of handling a preclear. It doesn't always work, but sometimes it works. And it's one of the oldest things man knows about people. You would walk up to this chap who was going down, always out of step, on the parade ground, and you would say, hey, why don't you get in step? The fellow said, oh, am I out of step? And immediately change pace and be in step. Do you see this? That is a totally allowable activity for you to come along and operate in life, not just in an auditing room, don't you see? You are totally at liberty to operate throughout any walk of life. And you're liable to see somebody quarreling, you know, with somebody else, and this other person has really been very tried their best. And somebody's being very, very angry with them, and you're totally at liberty to walk up to this other person and say, hey, why don't you give him a break? He probably didn't do it maliciously. Come off. You probably have some better way of solving this. You don't have to pick on him. You see? And this chap would look at you and, in days to come, see that you were a Scientologist and say, well, I guess, yeah, you got something there. Actually, he did chuck all those rocks at me, though. And you say, well, all right. What do we have, then? We have the first way of handling somebody or something. And the first way of handling somebody or something is, of course, to simply tell them to do it right. Now, if you omit this from your activities as an auditor, then you will eventually restrain yourself in this fashion. You will be sitting in an auditing room, auditing a preclear, and the preclear will be putting up mock-ups, cross-eyed, and you tell them to mock up a goat, and they're totally able to mock up a goat, and they mock up an elephant, you see? And you will never make the statement to them, hey, mock up a goat. You get the idea. Do you see where that enters in? Now, you have to know what he is doing in order to tell him what to do. Now, really, most auditors fail because they don't do that. It sounds very funny with all a tremendous hierarchy of postulates and information and so forth that we have. The failure of the auditor to directly direct and advise a preclear is usually the commonest auditor failure. So the ways we should handle a preclear begin with, do it right. I said, find a time when you were drunk. The fellow has told you for an hour all about times when he thought about drinking. And if you are doing a slow job at some vast sum per hour, of course this is admissible, maybe. But really it's bad auditing. He starts in, he says, yep, yep, yep. Well, I thought about being drunk once. You say, that's fine, realizing he has to as-is something there. And I thought about drug, and my mother used to think a lot about being drunk. You say, that's fine, that's good. Your mother used to think about it. Now, I ask you to recall a time when you were drunk. And the fellow said, well, I thought about, and you say, hey, whoa now. I want a time when you were drunk. Recall one. And the fellow said, oh, you mean recall a time? Oh, I get it, you know, recall a time. And there is an hour salvaged out of your processing time. Now, never drag a session out just because you have to put in some time auditing. I had, this is a classic example. During an ACC course one time, an auditor came in and things pretty clear came in, and they sat down in the lecture room about 35 minutes before the lecture began. And I was in there straightening out some of the decorations or something. I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well," he said, "we had a sort of bad session. We never got it started. There was only 35 minutes left. So we just knocked it off." And I said, "Only 35 minutes left. Have you got any idea what you could do in 35 minutes?" Phyllis said, "You can't do anything in 35 minutes. So I took his preclear by the collar and took him into the auditing room. And I said, in effect, be 3 feet back of your head. That's fine. Sun, moon, stars. Straightened him out, squared up his perception. And 15 minutes later, went back in and finished up the decoration thing. Now, that isn't how good I am. That has nothing to do with it, because I used the most standard procedures imaginable. But I had a certain impatience with a concept. It takes forever. That's the only thing that they're my credit. He might as well, because he knew the processes as well, have done this very thing with his preclear. But the preclear was feeling very poor because he had bounced back into his head or something of the sort, and he wasn't feeling very good about it. And 35 minutes was twice as much time as was necessary to put him into shape where he actually could do further study. You see, your idea of how long it takes is always susceptible to being telescoped. Not that you should be in a dread, sweating rush. It's all right to even have the frame of mind, "Well, so I'm going to process this fellow for 2,000 hours. That's all right. If you want to have that frame of mind, have that frame of mind. But don't have that frame of mind on a compulsive or obsessive basis. Don't ever. Don't assume because a little bird tells you or something. Just to say, "Well, I guess we'll go in for a long haul now with this preclear." All right, so we'll go in for a long haul with the preclear. But do as much as you can do. The idea of wasting a preclear is, of course, the same idea as auditing. It's quite amazing. But you're actually wasting aberration when you audit somebody and square him around. Do you see that? And sometimes an auditor gets to a point where he slows down and wants to take a long look, because really he's just wasted too much aberration. The point is he has gotten out of game, and the only way he could do this would be to consider auditing preclears the only game he could have. So that's something to be straightened out in the auditor, isn't it? You start solving too many of a preclear's problems, remember this. You need never be upset about it, because he came in with those problems. They are newly presented to you, aren't they? These problems then are newly presented to you, and therefore, your solving them actually doesn't as-is anything in you. You got that? The problem's walked in, so therefore knock them out. Similarly, you could have a preclear mock up something and as-is it, and 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 these cases remain right there, except for the benefit he'd get from the exercise. Do you see that? You wouldn't subtract from his havingness, or something of the sort. Well, similarly, if one got into such a frame of mind, it usually stems from not having enough preclears to practice on. So you want to be aware of that. I know a couple of dancers here, splendid dancers, who have laid off for some weeks in the hope of getting a central city engagement. And do you know they're starting to get creaky in the joints a bit? And one of these days, if they keep this up, they're going to say, "Well, actually, dancing is pretty hard work, you know, and boy, it has tremendous repercussions and so on. It's just dancing is getting scarce, that's all." The thing to do when you get leery about auditing is not just sheer off and go sit down someplace and think about it. You start to think about how auditing is hard work and that sort of thing. The thing to do is grab somebody by the nape of the neck and audit the living daylights out of them, you know. And you think for the first little while that you're doing this that you're practically being butchered. It might be very upsetting to her. But you get right back in the groove, and the first thing you know, you feel very comfortable about your own case. A preclear who self-audits, similarly, is wasting auditors in some fashion. He can't have an auditor. Now, you get a preclear that self-audits, and you say, "All right, now, let's get this session started." You find the auditor, you got an auditor here. He says, "Uh-huh. If you know from this man's history that he does a lot of self-auditing, he hasn't got any auditors. He can't have an auditor. How could you possibly jump and hurdle over this step? Because you're not there. And he tells you at the end of the first session that he audited himself half the night to put himself back in shape again, as they sometimes do. They are just telling you, I did not have an auditor yesterday, don't you see? So the scarcity angle of auditor and preclear is the next thing really of importance you have to handle. In other words, you have to be perfectly willing to make a direct statement to the person, be sane, conduct yourself properly, do right, snap into it. You have a perfect right to do that. And the next thing is, on the scarcity of auditors and preclears, you should understand that in handling a preclear, you yourself could get scarce on preclears, and preclears could get scarce on auditors, you see? And difficulties then could evolve immediately in the area of Scientology itself. Now, there really is no problem. You're solving his problems, and therefore the action of solving problems is to you very laborious. This does not. It balances out in the long run. The answer to that is a scarcity of preclears. Not that you're solving somebody's problems. Do you see that? All right, so in handling a preclear, you'd certainly have to know these two points because they are the chief points that could get in your road. An allergy for telling somebody straight off, do this, do that. And a feeling in yourself like you've just solved one too many problems with a preclear or something of this sort. That is scarcity of preclears, not others. All right, now in handling preclears, these things are paramount. The next thing you should know about handling people and so on is an interesting, very interesting facet. No matter how bad off the fellow looks to you, if he came to you for auditing, he's better off than the fellow who didn't. Do you see that? This fellow is out there whirling like a whirling dervish, and he never thinks that he needs anything. He's sane. He never needed any help anywhere. Well, it's very nice to have a self-assertive, independent, stand-upright sort of an attitude against all comers. There's nothing wrong with this at all. The fellow's playing the game one way or the other. But if he's doing this, and he's having a great deal of difficulty that he apparently doesn't observe, and he doesn't turn around to somebody that could give him a hand with this where he cannot himself act, he's worse off than the fellow who came to you. Now, there's just a tendency on the part of auditors to feel that they are dealing with the lowest of the low strata. This is not true. You find the people who call you up and ask you to solve their problems are in communication with society. The person who walks in and asks to be audited already has made the postulate that he could be better. And so you're really not dealing with the substrata of the population at any time. And you yourself should be aware of this. They are always worse off out there than in the auditing room. Now, so the next thing you should be able to handle is to be able to handle a chap who doesn't need, want, and cannot possibly experience anything like auditing. Now, how do you handle that fellow? Is there any process which comes up there? And this then becomes a very key process for Scientology at large. You get him to explain to you, you don't care at what length or with what ardor or how many comm breaks, why it is he does not need or want auditing. You got that? That is the specific solution to that difficulty. They eventually will come right into it. Right away with that is the primary tool of talking about Scientology itself, because you may be talking to this person also about Scientology. And that is a trick. It is a trick just as good as auditing. You maintain the C in the ARC and the A by maintaining the R. And you agree with whatever he says. And then say what you please, modified by that agreement. And the next thing you know, why, this chap is completely overthrown. He cannot fight this mechanism. And it's a mechanism which is peculiar to Scientology, even though it is occasionally and sporadically practiced elsewhere. We know why it is working, and that's quite important about a tool or a weapon, is to know why it fires. And so this chap comes up to you and says, well, you're just running a racket up here. You're running this group, and these poor people come in, and so forth. You say, you said it. There's a lot of money in it, too. And the fellow says, you well, you know, you are running a racket. Well, yeah, absolutely, everybody calls it a racket. It's a racket wherever healing is concerned, because these people are deluding themselves that there's anything wrong. You know that, and I know that. Of course, you're a smarter man, and you're wiser about the whole thing. For instance, you probably delude yourself about how well off you are all the time, too, don't you? And the guy would be thrown. You've overwhelmed him, is the truth of the matter. You took his game, took his ball, and then let him have it in his teeth. And you'll wind up every time, if you become expert with this mechanism, of never suffering because somebody shoves in your anchor points about Scientology, individually or in a group. You actually become sufficiently sharp and agile along in this line, studying its various mechanisms, that it's just an assignment of his own death warrant for a fellow to start picking on you. He just commits suicide just like that. Large group, he's going to show you up. He's a biologist, let us say, and he's going to show you this. He's read something about Scientology. He read it in some other book or something of the sort, and he's going to show you up. Just agree with everything. He says, all is matter, and you know it, and you say, absolutely. There are people who have the goofy idea, you know, of course, that there is a mind about it. But, of course, it takes a person with a mind to know that. In other words, by using this mechanism consistently, you'll find that it ordinarily cannot be overworked as far as people who don't know it is concerned, and people who do know it are simply rather amused and interested in your agility at handling this particular weapon. But it is the sword play of social intercourse. And in getting preclears, you had better know this one, because the husband of the wife who wants auditing is liable to be the one you have to talk to. And he knows it's all bad. And so you have to overwhelm his objections. So that mechanism becomes part of getting a preclear into session. Do you see? So just practice it, and you'll discover that it's seldom that you will lose. The only reason you'd lose is there's no terminal there to talk to. Now, you just agree and turn the tables. The most noteworthy and most horrible example of this was falling into it not too long ago. Somebody said, well, Scientology is a pretty good racket. You've got a pretty good racket mocked up, and but it's pretty rotten to have all of these people around monkeying with people. I said, you said it. I said, but it's a good racket. An American knows a racket when he sees one, but he knows how to make a good racket out of it. I said, you'll admit that it's a good racket. He says, it sure is. And I said, and as a matter of fact, it's being pretty horrible, it is. And the guy said, it is. Well, what do you mean? And I said, well, it's a dirty trick. I said, here, these little kids, they can't walk, they can't play. And you go out and fix them up, and they have to go and walk and play. I said, that's a dirty trick. There are people having unhappy married lives and things like that can't get along in life, and you straighten them out, and they have to go out in society and go to parties and work and do all sorts of things. And I said, there are people having a perfectly contented time sitting back and never seeing anybody, getting fed at the state's expense in mental hospitals and so forth, and you come along and you fix them up, and then they haven't got any further excuse for sitting back there in a dark cell. I said, it is a dirty trick. I agree with you 100%. And this guy was actually getting white. He was getting white. And the payoff on this is that he went to an auditor last week. He was trying to show me up in a group. He didn't get away with it. You see what a horribly blunt, crudely used weapon this can be. It doesn't even have to be very adroitly used. That was the most horrible frontal attack, holding the guy in communication. He can't get free of it because he's being agreed with. And you just hold him in and bring him a little bit closer and then machine gun him. And then he starts to fall out of communication. You agree with him some more and then pull him in close and machine gun him. And he eventually doesn't know what's happening to him. Now, you have to know how to sell Scientology. That is actually the answer to it. ARC. What is ARC composed of? You see, these tools are for use. Now, very often, your preclear starts blowing a session. This is one of the reasons you should be agile with this. He starts blowing session. And you keep on running the failure process. And he's going to blow session further, see? He feels he's being made to fail in some fashion. And maybe you, in trying to get through his communication upsets, are rather unable to get him twisted around so he'll get a win. And the next thing you know, he's just about ready to blow session, and he's not going to come back for the next session and that sort of thing. For heaven's sakes, remember this mechanism. He has some complaints to offer. Make him come up with them. The most basic trick along in this is, what have I done wrong? Individuals can never resist that. This works so well, by the way, that you can run a whole session free of boil-off or agitation by using it as a mechanism to show you how good it is. Just that one trick. What have I done wrong? Now, what have I done wrong here that upset you? You're assuming the responsibility for the action, which makes you responsible for the person, and which puts him back under auditing control again. Do you follow me? And yet it doesn't sound like that to the person, or even to you at first. What do you mean? I'm going to admit that I can be wrong, and I am the auditor, and I can be wrong? Oh, no. As a matter of fact, a person with that mechanism used on them runs without boil-off. The second they start to slump in any way, you just ask them, what have I done wrong, or some variation of this, and you'll find they'll snap into present time and begin to chit-chat with you and so forth. That's quite interesting. It's the assumption of responsibility. So if you assume the responsibility for the session in any way you can, at any time you can, just like agreeing with somebody, you assume full responsibility for the session, right and wrong. The preclear has no choice. It isn't going into long two-way communication with him, don't you see? It's assuming, whether it was there or not, that there was some point where the session went awry and that you are there to set it straight. Now, the way to lose a preclear completely is to insist that it was his fault. Because the one thing your preclear cannot do, of course, is to assume responsibility along that line, because he is being the preclear. Do you follow me? So in order to gain control of something, you assume responsibility for it. And that is a modus operandi as good in life as it is in auditing. If you went around saying to all the taxi drivers in London, some outrageous untruth that yet assumed responsibility for the ordinances or regulations of the driving of taxi cabs, you'd be riding free after a while. Do you see that this could happen? Now, to show you how interesting that is, a revolutionary group, and I'm not saying or offering this in any other way than just simply a practical life example of this, a revolutionary group which was losing very badly in a far-off country in a far-off age, started doing something very peculiar. They said they were responsible for every accident or occurrence that happened to any member of the government. Somebody'd fall downstairs, they pushed him. Wheel came off the carriage, they loosened the bolt. And they put out bulletins and told people they had done this, and they had done none of these things. And they finally had one of the hottest roaring parties that you ever heard of. Now, we're not a revolutionary group, but your preclear is very often a revolutionary group. 8 or 9 identities sitting there in a chair, and each one revolting against another one, and so on. And each one is trying to assume some responsibility and get rid of other responsibilities, and if you just assume a total responsibility on the whole line, you squash the whole crew. You see that? And to that degree, you take over the preclear so as to give him to himself, which is the primary mechanism of auditing. Well, these are little practical things, aren't they? Do they follow any particular plan? Yeah, they do follow a plan. They tell you at once that you must be capable in the game of being an auditor of playing well also the game of auditing preclears without making the preclear an opponent. Got the idea? And you in life have, as a Scientologist, certain targets and goals, which are on a much broader and higher level. I want to tell you something particularly about that, just as a little aside here. I spoke of a revolutionary group. I don't want you to get the wrong idea. Nobody should ever get the wrong idea concerning this. The game of mankind has normally been played by two opposing sides. These two sides are the military or the force representation of the society, and on the other side, that which represented the mind and spirit and could handle people individually and in groups. One side of this is uniformly attempting to regiment by threat, duress, so on. And the other side handles by smooth, quiet knowledge and control. Now, these two sides are normally present in any game of life. And they are particularly present and have been present repetitively down through the ages of man's governments. You always had the military on one side and the priest on the other side, somehow or another. The military and the priesthood. These two more or less jockeyed along in juxtaposition to each other. Now, people very often say the church and state and the church versus the state and so on. This is the shallowest and most inaccurate view you ever heard of. It is the military, the forceful elements in the society versus the peaceful, productive elements in the society. And this fight goes on forever, and standing between them and guided by both of them simultaneously always is a government. A government is always the wrong target for either of these two. They should assist a government. And you, in your role, should assist the controlling factors and beings that are. Because there's something very strange about this. Anytime a huge revolution or revolutionary group starts to march into and overthrow an existing regime, they set up, in consequence, a much worse regime of the same kind. And they just worsen your operating activity. That's really the conclusion and the end product of it. The laughable aristocracy, which was set up by Napoleon after the French Revolution, is something quite interesting. The modern commissar in Russia with his aristocratic airs are examples of what happens once an aristocracy is overthrown by revolution. They set up a new aristocracy. Nothing is ever bettered by this. Man is bettered by our lights, not by being shot at and jailed. He is bettered by being given more knowledge, more culture, more capability, and thereby can proceed to play interesting games which are far more entertaining than being beaten and whipped and so forth. It's maybe just our one-sided viewpoint. We don't particularly worry about force one way or the other, but it's our one-sided viewpoint that man and ourselves are better off in a fairly well-ordered and organized area of existence rather than in a tumultuous one. You'll find out normally that is the case. The laws and groups of force take over in chaos. So they wish to see chaos so that they can assume control. And they try to bring about a chaos and crush people into one shape or another with force and disrupt and disperse things and so on, so that at any key moment, why, somebody can spring up on a white charger and say, over this way, and you've got the same old government again, mostly because he hasn't imagination or creative enough to ever form anything else than what is right there, and he certainly would have an awful time educating an entire population, wouldn't he, into a new form of government. So Russian bureaucracy under the Tsar was the most appalling bureaucracy you ever heard of, and under the Commissar is the most appalling bureaucracy you ever heard of, you see? So that he uses patterns. Now, the priesthood of ancient Egypt or Chaldea or Babylon or of modern times is nevertheless a priesthood as such. And we ourselves, to some slight degree, detest the foul machinations that they very often engage upon to hoodwink and enslave. Very often there have been very bad priesthoods, but there have also been very good ones. And into modern times, we have, on the one hand, the feeble remnants of past church organizations. These are feeble remnants because they don't bark and have anybody in the street do anything. If one of them has come along at any moment and pat somebody on the forehead or make the sign of a cross in front of the fellow, say, "Wonder what's going on here," and flinch and go away and be a little bit upset or disturbed. Their level of control over the society at large is zero. On the other side of the throne today, in any governmental world, there is this old remnant of the priesthood close up against the throne. On the other side of this throne, you have the decadent military. The fellow with the rifle and the pistol, dressed up in a cute uniform, parading around once in a while, and who just about as much represents the force extant in the world today as little tin soldiers that you might wind up. They're cute, but are they useful? And a regiment of these charging madly into the teeth of an atomic scientist crew wouldn't last very long, would they? No, there are two new elements today in this world, and whether we like it or not, the atomic scientist and his technician 11 years ago were screaming for individual weapons so that they could be independent of any political control, and are today manufacturing them. Very interesting. But it's a very forthright, technical, scientific, tough-headed aspect about the control of man. And they couldn't care less. This is your new military. They're just appearing now over the horizon. And who appears in the other row? Who and what? Certainly, we're the only people on Earth today with any real knowledge of the workings of the mind and the habits and customs of man. We're seeing a new game on an old pattern. And whether we like it or not, we are going to be forced into the role of the rather quiet one who arbitrates, takes care of, straightens out, organizes, and civilizes man. And it will be into the teeth of the chaps with the big bombs and the little conscience. And so we have a new look, but neither one of these two actually have any business interfering with the civil government of man. See, they shouldn't interfere. Advise it, assist it, but don't interfere with it. You get the idea. Man is entitled to his government. And similarly, a preclair is faced on the one side by the driving control of the Thetan, thinkingness, culture, and on the other side by the forces of his machinery. And the government which he becomes in the middle of these is his self-determinism. Now, you as an auditor can handle his energy masses and spaces, and, on the other hand, can handle his thinkingness. The one which needs the least handling, oddly enough, is his thinkingness. To place his thinkingness in control of the mass and energies involved is to make a sane, self-determined person. To enhance and empower the masses and to overwhelm the self-determinism of a preclair. Every time he tries to originate a communication saying, I think I would rather be audited outside today, I keep looking at that spring sunshine and I say, oh man, I just can't stand it. I can't sit here no longer. Why don't we go outside and spot some people? Why don't we go outside and do that? And you say, oh no, you're going to sit right there, and so and so and so and so. You've knocked his self-determinism down just to that degree. Now, that was his self-determinism. He did want to go outside. He's saying some other time, oh, I don't want to run this. I don't want to run this. It's killing me. I mean, I won't answer that question one more time. And you say, well, okay, just like you say, you don't have to answer that question one more time if you don't want to. We can just knock it off, right? Oh, no! Well, we'll lighten it up. Just once more. Just once more. You'll say, all right. Yes, I can remember another time when my mother shot at my father or something of the sort. This is really not overthrowing his power of choice because you persuade him into an agreement. You see that? You should always persuade your preclairs into an agreement rather than come down on them with your hobnailed boots. But we are trying to bring about a self-determined attitude on his part. And this includes his handling of force as well as his higher spheres of ethics. And his self-determinism is very easy to reestablish if we remember that at no time are we really tremendously interfering with the preclear's own government. We're not making a slave out of him. And just as it works on the first dynamic, so it will work on the third and fourth. We're trying to persuade him to handle those masses. He agrees to handle them, and on a gradient scale, is able to. This would be the same thing as you maybe advising a government. You'd certainly better do something about this. I mean, you've got mobs running around in the streets, and you don't know. You better turn over to us a couple of big electronic megaphone so we can say, well, the prayer hour has arrived, folks. You better do something. You better turn over to us a little more territory here so we can take these people and get them fed and knock these riots apart for food. Let's get some order into here. You better get your soldiers out of there, too, because they're not doing a thing but infuriating that mob. You get the idea. That's totally legitimate. But it's not legitimate to say to the government, all right, we're now going to tell you exactly what to do, and we're your boss, and you can't in any way, shape, or form protest, and you may think one way, but we definitely think another way, and you're through, and you're dead, and so on. Unless you want all of life to go out of the society entirely and inherit the entire government of it yourself, unless you don't want. Believe me, you may think you want it occasionally, but you really don't. So, in handling a preclear, an auditor has parallelisms on many dynamics. Do you see this? Therefore, the various ways you handle preclears actually begin out of our own technology, and they apply to one dynamic as well as to another. And your sphere of action, observation, and so forth is not just an auditing room. But in an auditing room, you certainly should be able to assert and maintain skills and abilities which are something more than human. To get mad at a preclear when he gets mad at you immediately admits you into the situation of fighting with a preclear, and you have just assumed that you were a preclear. Well, that's an interesting thing for an auditor to assume. See, he's come down to the preclear's level. He's lost control of the situation. You can actually knock his spots off simply by saying, all right, now, what have I done wrong here now? See, we no longer have fight. It's the truth. He'll sputter on down and calm down finally and square around. You'll find out. You never want to leave a situation like that in any kind of an activity. All right, now, this seems to be perhaps a little bit esoteric, not particularly perhaps germane to an SLP. But if you realize that you have a game in progress where you have a preclear and that you are not playing a game with the preclear, you are playing a game yourself called Scientology, and part of it is a good, well, straightened out and capable preclear. And you're just going to add him to the team when you get him straightened out. He doesn't know this yet, but he has not yet been elected. You get the idea. All right. Auditing from that viewpoint, you have to then take into consideration all the elements of a game while auditing the preclear. You see, you have to take them all into consideration, including the fact that you are not trying to reach the preclear's most protected vitals. Two swordsmen stand up and fight with each other, and one of them is trying to stab the other's heart, and the other one's trying to stab the other one's heart. Okay? Psychoanalysis ran on this very reactively. They were trying to reach the preclear's heart, or the patient's heart. They were assuming that there was some deeply protected spot in the psyche of this person, and they were bound and determined they were going to reach it, and they did this on the pretense that there was something wrong with it. And this let them in. All right. Now, let's take on a little higher gradient, and let's take of force action, but much lower gradient on ethic, and find a long time ago an outfit called psychiatrists used to cut out people's brains. What were they doing but trying to reach a vital goal? If you add this up as a football field, and actually the behavior of problems under processing demonstrates that your preclear really is following the rules of football. There is a goal over there, or several goals over there, and he has one or more goals himself. And the opponents are trying to reach his goalposts, and he is trying to reach the opponent's goalposts, and this is the way it works out. I mean, that's the way it works out in auditing. And if you sit there as an auditor trying to reach the guts and vitals of some imaginary goalpost in your preclear, you will also give him loses because you have entered into playing a game with the preclear. See? Well, actually, it's a lot of fun to go around just bouncing a ball, not really playing games with the ball, just bounce the ball at different ways of bouncing balls and throwing them off the wall. And you know which way it's going to bounce and so forth. You can amuse yourself at that quite well without picking out the floor or the ceiling as your randomity, certainly. Well, you can pick up his aberrations and use them as a bouncing ball if you want to. But you're trying to put him back in the run. You keep your game out there in society, don't you see? The main game you're playing, and you are just taking the pre-clear as part of your game, you see? Otherwise, you will run this old gag of trying to reach his guts and vitals, the bottom of his psyche, the center of his prefrontal lobes. You're trying to find, as we were once doing in Dianetics, the basic on the chain. You're doing all of these various things, and you yourself are engaged in a whole bunch of reachingness and urgingness, and he senses this, and he begins to protect all of these things. Now, the way out of this, of course, is just to simply audit along the laws of games. And you start auditing along those ways, you get this at once as a fundamental procedure. Penalties apply to each one of the three parts, each one of the three parts of a game. And the three major parts of the game, freedom, problems, and havingness, must to some degree be in balance. Well, penalties apply to freedom, penalties apply to problems, and penalties apply to havingness. We must do something with many pre-clears along the line of penalties. And we get that in motivators, body motivators. It's just one of innumerable techniques that take care of penalties. Invent something to be afraid of is giving him a penalty, you see, of some sort, under the heading of problems, you know. And he'll mock it up, and he'll have something there under the heading of mass, too. And that he sees he is separate from it is under the heading of freedom. Well, a pre-clear is pretty jammed up on these three points all the way down the bank, you see. And the point he gets jammed up is on the penalty line. So sometimes you'll find yourself having to process penalties because the pre-clear is really not in any game. Remember that. That's a very good one. He's really not in any game. And he's having a rough time of it. He's between games or something of the sort. We have a pre-clear, for instance, who is between games. Let us say that this fellow repairs motor cars. He repaired motor cars for a long time, and now he is hopefully studying in another field. But he hasn't learned how to do that other field, and he still occasionally repairs motor cars, and he's really interiorized into motor cars. And he's doing all the things that a motor car will do while he's being audited. He's being repaired. If you ask him closely, he'd tell you his differential was probably out of order or something of the sort. We get the consistent technical problem with the technician that he is usually interiorized into machinery which he has had to handle intimately. A little offbeat that you should look at, because he's interiorized into an old game. He's in the playing field or the playing tools of an old game. And so we get this mechanism, and it works out along the penalty line. If he's interiorized into the tools or playing field of an old game, he must be suffering from a penalty, you see? And that is the way we work it out. And there's about our lowest level in entrance, just the assumption that this man is sitting in a penalty line, and we're going to boost him out of that. And we boost him out of it, however, on a quite balanced formula. We get him to create, survive, destroy. Anyway, you want to look at it. We're going to rehabilitate these three things. And along the penalty line, we're still going to give him freedom, problems, and havingness. We're going to ask him, can you tell me a penalty which you're not at this moment suffering? I mean, just as bluntly as this. This is a freedom process, you know. Something that you're not being punished for at this moment is, of course, a problem level. See? Problem he is not particularly mixed up with. Or could you invent something to be punished for? You see? Let's say, however, he couldn't invent anything. We know that this is a dead loss. Have him lie about it. Can you tell me a lie about punishment? Can you tell me a lie about penalties? Could you tell me a lie concerning jails? Could you tell me a lie about what you used to have? Any such thing. It'll start him creating something. In other words, we have a generative point. Your pre-clear can almost always lie. And you get him to lying about the environment. We rehabilitate his inventiveness. We best do it by rehabilitating it in one of these three levels. Now, penalty actually starts at the bottom, and then we go up mood of game, and we find the mood of game is stuck, and it is stuck along any one of the three points or compartments of games. There's the mood of game on a freedom. I am not mad, see? I'm free from being mad, the fellow's saying. I never get mad when I beat my wife, or, you know. And then problems. You could ask the individual, invent a proper emotion with which to do arithmetic. You know, just picking one out of the hat. What is a proper emotion which do arithmetic? He probably may tell you at once franticness, but you ask him to invent one. He can't invent one. You've overshot already. You would have to drop back to lies. You say, tell me a lie about a mood in which you're doing arithmetic. Well, to be calm and happy. Yeah. You know, something on this sort. And then we would go over into havingness along this same line, and we find out that emotions have masses connected with them. And we just have him plaster anger or something like that into the walls. This is the oldest, most crude of these processes, you know. Just go up the tone scale, have him put apathy in all the walls a lot of times, and anger and other things. You can even have him put bad perception into the walls, and you can have him put blackness into the walls. You know, there's more than one man has gotten over these black fields simply by plastering the walls with blackness, on and on and on and on and on, until he was sure he could create it. All right? Here are three various spheres of actions and two primary things to process in them, penalties and mood. See, and the mood, of course, is tone scale, and the penalties are punishments of one kind. And each havingness has moods and penalties, and problems has moods and penalties, and more important, these things, all of these various component parts that you know of in Scientology fit in here somewhere. Now, to give you an idea of the type of process which could come out of this, let's take one of the most basic processes there is, and let's have the individual really process a game. See, just straightforwardly process a game. We assume that he is protecting something. See, that would be his own goal. Just get the idea of two goalposts, one at one end of the field, one at the other end of the field, and he's standing out there as the team and the goalie all combined, you see. Now, he's either plastered and wrapped up all around this goalpost, you see, at which time he'd be in rather bad shape, or he's well out into the field to catch the frontal attack. And either way, he's still protecting a goalpost, and he's always doing this to some degree. And at the same time, if he's in fairly good shape, if he's all gone, he isn't doing this at all, but if he's in fairly good shape, he has some hope of somehow or another, by some trick or another, plastering one into the other fellow's goalpost. Now, the complication of life is he's playing in a dozen games, and there's dozens of other goalposts, you see. So it's a little more complicated playing field, but that's about all. He usually also has a number of things he could protect. Maybe he's in terrible shape, and if he's in terrible shape, he is doing something very weird. He's trying to find some kind of a goalpost for him to attack way over there. And we get the fellow who's buttered all over the universe, you know. He's saying, I have nothing to protect here at all. I mean, I'm innocent. I'm not in this game. You know, he's giving you all sorts of odd misleads. He's saying, actually, they sometimes will talk to you about the hour of all the things they've lost. You know, they say, actually, I lost a car up in Sussex one time, and it was just stolen, and afterwards was sitting on the street, and so. Well, he hopes you'll go attack that car. You get the idea. He's misleading. He's doing a red herring as far as what he's protecting is concerned. So we enter into immediately the idea of a game, and we ask him this key question. We just ask him bluntly, what could you protect? And the fellow says, comlag. And the next thing that he says probably is, oh, I don't know, I could probably protect, the carbon on the wick of my cigarette lighter, or something like that. See? You say, well, that's fine. You say, well, that's true, and nobody else wants it. And that's usually his philosophy. He can protect those things which nobody else wants. So he'll give you enormous numbers of things which nobody else wants before you get him out of his slough's pond. All right? And you say, that's fine, and you have him remedy his havingness with it. Believe me, that's awfully minute to remedy havingness with, isn't it? Some particles of carbon on the end of a cigarette lighter. And you say, well, that has no mass. The oddity is we're very close to his reality level. And we find, if he tells us this, that he normally will then have reality on that, and it will remedy havingness, whereas nothing else he's run has ever remedied havingness. You've had him mocking up unrealities and pushing them around and so on, they weren't real, and it wasn't changing his case any. But he tells you he can protect this. He's fairly sure that, well, all right, you have him remedy havingness with it. And if you have him remedy havingness with it, you've gotten one part of the game, haven't you? All right, therefore, we'd have to have a second part to the game. We'd have to have him invent some problems, or lie about it until he could invent some problems, concerning the carbon on the end of the cigarette lighter. Then, the next one up the line, of course, we would ask him about some freedom from, in some fashion, usually pertinent to cigarette lighters, or pertinent to the carbon at the on the wick of a cigarette lighter. Don't you see? You'd get the gimmick, and then you would add the three parts of the game, and then you would remember that there was another part to the game. If you ask him what he could protect, you want to know what he could attack. Only attack is too tough a word for this preclear. So you use in the initial stages something else. You say, what could you reach? Just right out of the blue, ask him what he could reach. Now, don't run it very long, because he's going to exhaust a lot of havingness early in the game. But what could he reach? And he'll finally assume and opine that he could reach Mars. It'll usually be, if he's the carbon on the end of the wick of a cigarette lighter, he'll give you some completely unreasonable thing that he could reach. And he'll be fairly sure he could reach it, you know. It'll be a real goofball one. Didn't expect coming up, so don't challenge him on it. He's got an idea he could reach that. That's fine. You have him reach a couple of things. You pat him on the head. You say, that's swell. And then you go right back again to the basic process. What could you protect? And he goes into a new comm lag, and off he takes. Don't you see? And you go right through the routine again. So no matter what you processed, you would have to some degree, go through the routine of the two goals and the three parts of the game, and the various adjuncts to these three parts. Each would need some sort of attention, you see. And if you started doing that with somebody, he would eventually come up and you'd ask him strong questions. You'd say, all right, now what can you protect? And he'd say, oh, I don't know, I could protect, I can protect London. All right, that's fine. What's remedy having this with it? And, all right, now some problems London could be, and get some of those, you know, invent some of those, and then, can you tell me any separateness you have from London? You see, in remedy havingness, you also could throw it away. You could also have asked separateness, by the way, at that point. Some points in London from which you're separate. Something on this angle would have worked quite as well as throwing it away. And then, that's at low stages. Freedom is a higher concept than separateness. And you would eventually said then, all right, now what can you attack? You know, just bluntly. Oh, I don't know. What could I attack? This is a new type of comlag. He's starting to take satisfaction in the idea of attacking all of Italy, or knocking out the entirety of Africa, or something like this. And he goes over this as a great possibility. Very nice idea. He may decide he's taken in too much territory with a Western Hemisphere or something like that and narrow it down to merely North America. But he gets ambitious. Now, from building up big, you can expect him occasionally to fall back small. It's quite an interesting phenomenon. Just as you have an individual spot spots in space on an old process, and he's reaching out, spotting spots in space, spotting spots in space, spotting spots in space. Oh, they're way, way out. And then they get nearer home, and 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 finally spotting spots inside of his eyeballs or something like this. And then he's spotting spots further out and further out, and then way, way, way out again, you see? And then in, close. And you'll see this variation. So he does this variation while processing games. Now, everywhere we find a preclear incapable, we find the incapability to be matched up with some portion of a game. He is holding down to some degree his own capabilities. He is giving himself in some way or another penalties. Some of his games are totally interiorized games where he's playing both sides in the middle and both goals and so on. The fellow who's self-auditing is usually playing games with a ridge that's out in front of his face. He's trying to reach some unattainable part of the bridge. He decides that it's unattainable, and then he tries to reach it, and then he gets the idea that the ridge may be trying to reach him, and so on. He's playing a game very close to home. There are many, many angles to such a basic regimen of processing. I don't give it to you as the regimen of processing. I will tell you, though, that individuals come out of old games in an awful hurry with this sort of process. And you also can reach a low-level reality with the pre-clear, which you can then process. And also tell you that he comes on upscale and regains a lot of ability, but more than that, can look around and see a bigger game. Now, the trouble, your pre-clear is game blind. He can't see a bigger game than he's in. He wouldn't have any reassurance or any assurance at all if there was any bigger game than he's playing. He's playing the game of I have to have an ear twitch. Now, I'm trying to find the center of this ear twitch, and it's trying to find the center of me. You get the idea. And they're going back and forth with this ear twitch. And so he comes in and complains to you about the ear twitch. Because, my golly, he's losing that game. Well, that's terrific. So he needs a coach or something like that. Just like he might go out and take lessons in playing golf or something. So he might come to you and find out how to reach the middle of the ear twitch. And then you do so and his game's over. Well, the thing for you to do is to build up his capability in games rather than keep ending the games he's playing. That's why he should be left with his ear twitch. He'll get rid of his ear twitch when he can play another bigger game. Now, what is there that is running out while an individual is com-lagging on what could I protect? What is there running out? He obviously is running out some sort of an emotion, isn't he? There must be some kind of a computation or a feeling and so forth. And he is really running out an inability to protect, an inability to fend off. And do you know that he has all of the ages that he has been on the track attempted to instill this emotion into his opponents? And eventually it's collapsed on him. And they have tried to instill it into him. And it's eventually collapsed on them. So he himself is trying to be able while making others unable in the play of the game, don't you see? And it's that that runs out. Now that can be processed directly when you spot it. It's just the emotion he gets when you ask him the question, what can you protect? And he does a com lag. He's getting an emotion during that time. And it's failure to protect, unable to protect, impossible to protect. Whatever this emotion comes up as, it is not advisable to do this at once, you see, because it's just an emotional thing. There is something there, though, that he tried to instill loss into the opponents while winning himself. And, of course, this role has eventually reversed, and he finds himself in a bad situation. An auditor, too, begins to be reached by pre-clears when he loses too often in auditing sessions. That's why we mustn't have losing auditing sessions, because it's not a game. So auditing is something different. There are various ways of handling it. I have just given you some of the regimens which you might be interested in. There are innumerable things you can do, but these are all in the lines of, well, think a place thought is a wonderful exteriorization process, but it simply exteriorizes the pre-clear, and so therefore belongs under the heading of freedom, doesn't it? And so you can categorize any process you have under these various categories, and so can understand them a lot better. And I hope this will be of assistance to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.